Welcome to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. The right of the public to know what our government does, how, when, and why, is basic to our American system of democracy. Most states and the federal government have enacted laws requiring public meetings to be open, with substantial prohibitions against secrecy. Also, there are laws guaranteeing the public access to records kept and maintained by the government. The California First Amendment Coalition, based in Sacramento, California, has published a book entitled Legal Notebook: How to Keep Open Meetings Open and Public Meetings Public. Our guest in this archive edition of Radio Curious, recorded and broadcast in the fall of 1998, is Terry Frank, a California attorney who is the general counsel for the California First Amendment Coalition and author of this book. I asked Terry Frank to begin by describing the circumstances under which an otherwise public meeting may be closed to the public.
The law on that varies from state to state, but many of the open meeting laws of the states recognize some very common exceptions, which allow bodies such as city and county organizations and school boards to confer confidentially outside the presence of the public. Perhaps the most common is when it's necessary to talk frankly about an actual or a prospective employee and his or her competence or performance or personal merit, the so-called personnel session. The law allows applicants for a job to be reviewed confidentially if indeed the district is small enough and the position is close enough to the body to involve the body in that kind of thing.
In other words, where would a teacher situation fit in?
Well, in a situation where a teacher is being personally reviewed by a school board or is the subject of a possible disciplinary action or has other personal performance issues to be discussed by the school board, then there's that kind of closed session.
But would the teacher be able to say, I want this session to be open? Does the teacher hold the privilege?
Some circumstances, yes. In California, if it's a kind of closed session where the board is reviewing specific complaints or charges about the teacher's performance, then the law says that not only the teacher has the, and this is true for all employees, by the way, not just teachers, that the employee not only has the right to insist on an open airing of the charges in an open session, but specifically must be informed of that in writing.
Informed of the right of being able to have a public meeting?
Yes.
On their private employment matters.
First, before the meeting at which complaints or charges would be discussed otherwise in closed session. So if a teacher or any other employee is in the kind of trouble that involves specific allegations of misconduct, for example, then that teacher must be notified at least 24 hours in advance so that he or she can elect whether or not to demand an open airing. Many of them, my reading is almost all go ahead and allow for a closed session anyway because they're not sure exactly what's up. But this rule is there to allow teachers who are convinced that they're being falsely accused or railroaded, I keep saying teachers, but it applies to all employees, to essentially force their accusers, or at least the accusations, to come out in the open so they can challenge them openly.
Does this apply to students as well as teachers?
No.
Can a student have a closed hearing, or is it required to be open?
The first part part of it doesn't apply. That is the sort of advising of rights. It is true that in a disciplinary situation where the school board, again, is getting involved directly in suspension, for example, or expulsion decisions, the student and or the parent, who usually makes the operative decision, may insist on an open airing of the charges.
How about other circumstances where the school board or the local elected body can meet in secret?
Perhaps the other most common one, again, at least here in California, is the occasion for a body having a consultation with its attorney on matters of pending litigation. And that latter phrase, pending litigation, is a kind of, is a term of art. It doesn't necessarily mean what one might think it means. It does indeed refer to an existing lawsuit that the city or county or school district is involved in, and that's the classic use of it, to allow the body to confer with the attorney, how are we doing, what's our next step, what are our strengths and weaknesses, what guidance would you like from us? It's just an attorney-client, a consultation where the client happens to be 5 to 7 people. But that's not the only situation. The law also allows for the body to look ahead a little bit and decide if it is likely to be sued. This is where it gets tricky, because we don't want to close session every time something comes up that is controversial enough that someone somewhere might sue about it. And so it's required that in order to close the session to talk about the prospective litigation or potential future litigation, that the body either identify what it is that is that constitutes the threat. Who is saying that they're going to sue the district or the city, and why? So that people don't have to wonder, is this a bona fide case of a litigation threat, or is it simply bogus? And there's one more situation, of course, where the city or county may be discussing whether to sue somebody else. In that case, that's essentially what they have to say on the agenda, just that much, and the public is indeed left with a little bit of mystery, but may be sued.
In other words, the local board can say, we're thinking about suing entity or Mr. X, and that's all they can. That's all they have to do.
In essence, yes, they're not required to identify the potential defendant. Whereas if they're afraid of being the defendant, they are required to identify the potential plaintiff.
How about in a situation where they want to purchase or get a long-term lease on some real estate, and they're afraid there may be some litigation that flows from it? Does the discussion about the purchase or lease have to be in the open?
Well, that is a really completely separate basis for a closed session. And there does not need to be any litigation in the picture. In fact, there probably shouldn't be, because at this early point, if what you're worrying about is some litigation that might emerge from the outcome of a property purchase or a lease or something like that, that's very far down the track and quite speculative. So the law wouldn't permit a litigation session under those circumstances, but what it would permit is for the city council or school board to hold a closed session with its negotiator, its own bargaining agent, in the negotiations to buy the property. And one thing that is sometimes a source of confusion here is that the body is not allowed to decide whether to try to acquire a piece of property or get rid of it in closed session. That is a policy decision that must be discussed publicly. And so the question of whether or not to sell the corner property that the city's had for 20 years on the corner of Oak Street, That is a matter for public discussion. But once they find, once they make that decision in open session, and then they find a prospective buyer, then they can hold a closed session not with the buyer or the buyer's representative, but with their own bargaining agent to supervise the progress of the negotiations and offer new instructions and so forth, at least as far as the issues of price and terms of payment are concerned. But again, before going into that kind of closed session, they have to say, in so many words, we are negotiating with Jim Jones or Jane Smith. That is the person who's interested in buying the property on the corner of Oak Street. So they have to identify both the other party to negotiations and the particular parcel or building that is under negotiation.
Well, Terry, would it be a fair statement then to say that other topics of elected bodies must be done in public?
Most of them. The only other one that comes up with any kind of frequency, the only other kind of exception, is where the employees are bargaining for increases in pay or benefits. And that has two forms. If we're talking about an employee union, then you have pretty much the same kind of a situation of a closed session by the board to talk with its own negotiator, who then goes back and negotiates with the union, but no direct negotiation with the union. The other situation is where it's not a union, but a couple of individual employees, usually executives who are, by definition, never going to be unionized, but because they're the chief executive. They may be the superintendent or some department heads or the city manager, and someone is representing the board in negotiating directly with them for an increase in salary or a new contract or something like that that implies an increase in negotiation. Again, a closed session is permitted there between the body and its bargaining agent, not the other side. And the difference there is that any final action on the individual's contract or pay increase must be in open session.
Well, Terry, what to do? What is the citizen to do if they feel that the closed session law is violated and the public's business is done in secret?
I think it depends on when they discover that. I'm going to have to talk in terms of California, but I think that most states have comparable rules. And if you see something happening right before your eyes, because you're at a meeting of the city council or the school board, and, for example, they bring up something that is not on the agenda, and they tear right into it, and it looks like they're going to take action, and the only reason you know about it is because you're sitting right there, but no one else does, that's usually a violation of the law, or at least it is in California. Action can't be taken on matters that were never on the agenda for the public to be aware of. And so there is a way to stand and ask to be recognized and protest that this is not allowed by the law.
Before you explain that way to stand and ask to be recognized and how to be successful in doing it, I want to take a moment and say that our guest this week is Terry Frank, an attorney in Sacramento who's affiliated with the California First Amendment Coalition. He's also the author of their publication called Legal Notebook, How to Keep Open Meetings Open and Public Meetings Public. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Terry, what should someone do under those circumstances?
Well, I think first opportunity, or perhaps to even to create the opportunity, you go to the podium or whatever lectern arrangement is provided for speakers who are addressing the body, and it's not necessary to get into any technicality about point of order or that sort of thing. You simply ask to be recognized and tell the person presiding, the mayor or the school board president or whoever, that according to your understanding of the open meeting law, What they're about to do is not permitted because it's not on the agenda or because closed session isn't permitted on this sort of thing, whatever applies to the situation.
And if they continue and refuse to recognize that statement, what then?
Well, that's the most that you can do at that particular point. If, and I stress if, you were extremely confident that you were correct on an issue of closed meetings, so that they were essentially telling the public to leave, but you were absolutely confident that you knew the law and the law didn't permit them to close the meeting for what they were trying to do. But then, of course, you could just sit in place and cause them to have to decide whether, you know,
either hold the meeting elsewhere or arrest you.
Do they really want to try to get you ejected and risk a false arrest charge, or do they want to simply back off from their decision to hold the closed session? Or, you know, of course, sometimes what they will do is simply open the door behind them, walk into a room, and lock it behind them. But ordinarily, the best thing to do is, if you can, when you can, make your point before the activity happens, so that at least they can't say, well, no one protested, no one brought it to our attention. That's about all you can do.
But a failure to protest does not make it a valid activity on their part.
No, it does not. It does not. It simply makes it harder politically for them to say, well, we did it because it seemed the right thing to do and no one suggested there was anything wrong with it. Legally speaking, of course, and I refer to the Brown Act for California, depending on what kind of violation we're talking about, you have 30 to 90 days to react. And, for instance, if it's something that happens right there in the open session, but it was not on the agenda, then you've got 30 days to submit a written demand for cure and correction. And this is essentially a letter, simply a letter sent to the offending body saying, on such and such a date, you did this. The Brown Act or the open meeting law requires to the contrary or prohibits that kind of thing. I am demanding that you cure or correct that violation by doing the following. And here you can be creative depending on exactly what kind of action by them would tend to remove the taint or problem that they caused by the illegal surprise or secrecy. So, for example, if it's a problem of something not being on the agenda, logically you would want to ask them to suspend or rescind whatever action they took and place the matter on the agenda of a coming meeting so that the whole public can understand what's going on and can come and comment.
Let's talk about agendas for a minute.
Yes.
What the agenda should say, where it should be distributed, the opportunity to make it available to the average citizen?
Well, under the law of California for local agencies, for example, and I think these are pretty much the same everywhere, the body is required to post an agenda, that is a list of things that are to be discussed and or acted upon, either one, at least one place within their territories. If it's a city, somewhere within city limits. And it must be a place accessible to the public. And for a regular meeting, for example, it must be up and out there and accessible to the public 72 hours in advance. And so what that usually means is that the city or school board must either have a kind of public bulletin board out in the open air someplace, or perhaps tape their agendas to the inside of a glass door someplace, but it should be available for people to see.
So that someone can see it on a Saturday night for a Monday evening meeting.
Right. That's right. It doesn't do much good to say that you posted something 72 hours in advance if 48 of those hours has it on a bulletin board deep in the bowels of a building that isn't open to the public.
And what does the agenda item itself have to contain?
It has to contain what the law calls a brief general description. And the law says that generally the description needn't exceed 20 words. It has to, and admittedly sometimes this is a little tricky, but what it has to do is give people who you would think would care about something enough of an idea about what is up, what is planned to be discussed or acted on, so that they can make an informed decision about either, you know, whether to get further information or indeed whether to come to the meeting. And obviously this is not a matter of requiring great detail on things that are often very detailed, but it's a matter of using that handful of words to grab people's attention and say, this thing is going to be discussed or acted on.
So that means that the writer of the agenda can either make it a very telling 20 words or a very blah, non-descriptive 20 words, and that's really up to the local writer, the clerk of the board or something?
It is, and there are very few challenges to the language as such.
Well, let's assume that someone catches on and they want more information. What information would they be entitled to see if they go to the clerk's office before the meeting?
They'd be entitled to see, number one, certainly if we're within the time limit that the school board or the city council has already been given its packet of materials for the meeting, they're entitled to see anything in that packet, the entire packet, at least to the extent we're talking about matters that would be in open session. So they're not going to see an attorney-client memorandum, for example, but they will see perhaps a staff memo on a project having to do with the street closure or something like that. These are public records. They would be public records anyway, but in the closing days before a meeting, in that 72-hour period, or at least whenever it's been given to the board, they're entitled to them immediately and unhesitatingly. So the difference is that sometimes you ask for records which you know eventually are going to be conceded as public, but sometimes the agency will take its time and may string out several days in making up its mind that, well, this is public.
But before a meeting, they have to give it to you.
That's right. There's no agonizing, no argument. If there's something that is handed out to the board or the council in connection with an open and public meeting, you get it when you ask for it.
And if you don't get it when you ask for it, does that limit the right of that elected body to act on the agenda item at the upcoming meeting?
Unfortunately, no, it does not. But what it does is make it politically embarrassing, let's say. And I must say, as a kind of a parenthesis for all this we're talking about, I keep talking about legal rules, of course, but
it's really the politics that control.
Politics is a very powerful overlay over all this. So if I had some clerk tell me that I couldn't get a copy of part of the agenda packet that was going to be discussed in open session, I guess the first thing that I would do is call the presiding officer, the mayor, or the president of the school board, and yell bloody murder.
And I guess it's important to emphasize that the mayor or the president of the school board are just regular folks like the rest of us, and they are approachable. Their numbers are usually in the phone book.
That's right. They are either in the phone book or they have to have, you've got to be able to get an accessible number through voicemail or something through the school board itself. So there should be a way of reaching them in very short order. And yes, they are at least as regular folks as the rest of us.
Though they may not think so. Terry, I want to thank you for joining us on Radio Curious. And as we come to the end of our time, I would like you to take a minute and explain what the California First Amendment Coalition is and does, if you can summarize it in a minute.
Sure. It's a nonprofit organization about 10 years old this year, which comprises a number of media professional organizations like the California School Boards Association, the California Newspaper Publishers Association and the Society for Professional Journalists, but also has many public members with a common goal of helping people understand their rights to get information, to attend open and public meetings under the law, and to express themselves with the rights given them under the First Amendment. So we do education. We have a public hotline free to anyone who has questions about their rights, about the same things we're talking about tonight.
Can you tell us the hotline number, please?
It is area 916-974-8888. 916-974-8888.
Well, Terry Frank, I want to thank you for joining us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I want to ask you the question I ask all of my guests at this time. And that is, could you please tell us of an interesting book that you've read lately?
Yes, and I'm glad you gave me a little bit of warning before the show about this, because I just went to check the title out. It's called Who Killed Homer? It's by a couple of classical scholars, Greek and Latin, here in California, who are talking about the tragedy of how instruction in Latin and Greek have disappeared and what that subtracts from our ability to understand not B.C., but contemporary life. Because if you really look at what was happening in ancient Athens and Rome, you don't have to find any other examples for some of the problems we're looking at today. Anyway.
Well, Terry Frank, I want to thank you for joining us on Radio Curious.
Terry Frank is the author of Legal Notebook, How to Keep Open Meetings Open and Public Meetings Public. The book that he recommends is Who Killed Homer? The Demise of Classical Education and the Recovery of Greek Wisdom by Victor Davis Hanson and John Heath. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $10 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. The phone is 707-462-6541. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org. You've been listening to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.